From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Four little girls. On September 15, 1963, a bomb ripped through 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama, killing four children. This week, two ex-Klansmen were charged with their murder. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. This news from Birmingham, Alabama. Two longtime suspects in the 1963 bombing of a black church were jailed this week after a grand jury returned murder indictments against them. Thomas Blanton Jr. and Bobby Frank Cherry, one-time members of the Ku Klux Klan, surrendered to authorities in Alabama on Wednesday. They're the two living suspects in one of the most shocking racial crimes in U.S. history. Blanton, Cherry, and two other men, also Klan members, were implicated in the original FBI investigation in 1965, but were not charged. Robert Edward Chambliss was finally given a life sentence in 1977 for his role in the crime and died in prison 8 years later. A fourth suspect, Herman Frank Cash, died without being brought to justice. On September 14, 1963, members of the 16th Street Baptist Church were gathered for Sunday services. The title of the sermon that day was The Love That Forgives. Suddenly, a dynamite bomb exploded, demolishing a wall of the church. The blast killed four young girls, 11-year-old Denise McNair, and three 14-year-olds, Carol Robertson, Cynthia Wesley, and Addie Mae Collins. 20 others were injured. The killing served to galvanize opposition to segregationist policies in the South. And Birmingham had become a focal point in the struggle for civil rights. It was nicknamed Bombingham because of the many black churches and homes that were destroyed by the Klan and its sympathizers. And just months before the bombing of the 16th Street Church, Birmingham Police Chief Eugene Bull O'Connor had unleashed fire hoses and police dogs on black civil rights marchers led by Dr. Martin Luther King. Well, today we bring you excerpts of a documentary by Spike Lee called Four Little Girls. It chronicles the 37-year-old tragedy and the effect it had on the civil rights movement. We'll begin by hearing from the relatives of Denise McNair, including her mother and her father. We later hear from Carol Robertson's mother and sister, and the Reverend Wyatt T. Walker, Chief of Staff for the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. But we begin with Joan Baez.
Come round by my side, and I'll sing you a song. I'll sing it so softly it'll do no one wrong. On Birmingham Sunday the blood ran like wine, and the choir kept singing of freedom. That cold autumn morning, no eyes saw the sun, and Addie Mae Collins, her number was one. In an old Baptist church there was no need to run, and the choir kept singing of freedom. Clouds, they were dark, and the autumn wind blew, and Denise McNair brought the number to two. The falcon of death was a creature they knew, and the choir kept singing of freedom. Church, it was crowded and no one could see that Cynthia Wesley's dark number was three. Her prayers and her feelings would shame you and me, and the choir kept singing a of freedom. Young Carol Robertson entered the door, and the number her killers had given was 4. She asked for a blessing, but asked for no more, and the choir kept singing of freedom. Shook the ground, and people all over the earth turned around. For no one recalled a more cowardly sound, and the choir kept singing of freedom. They once asked of me, how many blackberries grow in the blue sea? I asked them right back with a tear in my eye, how many dark ships in the forest? The Sunday has come, the Sunday gone, and I can't do much more than to sing you a song. I'll sing it so softly you know I'm wrong, and the choir keeps singing of freedom.
Denise was a very charming child, a very lovable child, and a very caring child. I think she spent most of her time trying to do for other children. She had a good group of friends and lived in the community. And a lot of times she would come down to my house.
Oh, she loved to come over here because at that time she was an only child. And there were 4 children in this house. And two girls and 2 boys.
She couldn't wait to find out what everything was about, see what this is and know what this person is and talk to everybody. She was very friendly and seemingly very happy.
Very aggressive, very feisty. You know, obviously when somebody's not around, you tend to praise sometimes even where praise may not be due, but very inquisitive, and very much a leader.
She was a very lovable little girl, and I miss her.
Get a job was a real chore, especially if you came to this blue-collar town and you had a college degree and you were going to steel mills and places like that, making applications, and nobody's looking for any more college graduates.
Birmingham's a steel town. Birmingham was built in the late 1800s by the barons from the north who came down and realized that we had every combination. We had people, we had natural resources, we had river transportation.
It grew by leaps and bounds. It was known as the Magic City because it grew so fast. But you had people coming in, a laboring class of people, a blue-collar town. And it was a violent town.
It was a union, a town of union violence, condoned, the violence against workers condoned by the police and by United States Steel and the other big industrial companies. It had a long history of labor violence. So you had a tradition of violence flowing out of an industrial setting with the overlay of rural racism coming in from the countryside, traditional Old South racism.
With that background, the 50s were a time of quietness here. Wonderful place to live, and raise a family.
Birmingham was just Birmingham. White color, not white, black, white color.
You would have to have lived here to understand some of the feelings that were going on at that time.
Black people were in their places and white folk were in theirs, if that's such a thing. And the water fountains, black and white, and all of those kind of things existed and existed in order.
You may see in some of the pictures, you know, caps which said colored only, caps which said white only, bathrooms at the bus station, you know, white only.
I have an older brother, and there were two of us like 9 or 10 months apart, and my mother would have to make a choice. And she would always just let one of us drink from the white fountain, one of us drink from the black fountain. And she knew that that was in violation of the law, but she did it anyway.
And it was so hard to tell your child, your 6 or 7 year old, and it's time for water. You know, they wanted some water. And maybe the child attempted to go to a fountain that was marked for white, and you would have to tell him, so, no, let's take this fountain, rather than, and say, well, why can't I go to the other? There's nobody there. So, well, no, we'll just use this one. It was an awful time. It was an awful time for young people, I'd say, to grow up in this city.
When my daughter Denise was about 6 years old, and I've always despised going shopping with my wife, because my patience doesn't hold for go shopping, you know. But at any rate, this was Christmas and we were shopping. And we had come to a store, in fact, it was Cress's. We were going in there to buy some ribbons. And when we got into Cress's, Denise said she had to go to the restroom. So we went downstairs where the restroom were, black and white again, black and colored, I beg your pardon. White in color. And so when we got down there, the lunch counter was also in there, and you could smell the onion, the hamburgers, and Denise said she wanted a sandwich.
And it was kind of painful to say, no, you can't have it. She wanted to know why. And we had to tell her the sage-old story about whites only can eat here, but we can't. We'll eat when we get home. She didn't understand that so hard.
That was the night that I made up my mind that I guess I had to tell her that she couldn't have that sandwich because she was black.
I guess for men it's worse than it is for women because they are more sensitive, or I guess that's what you might call it. They hate to say, well, my child can't do what everybody else's child can do, and it makes me mad that I can't do anything about it. I can't change it right now.
Well, I want you to know that night couldn't have been any more painful than seeing her laying up there with a rock smashed in her head than to tell her that I couldn't buy her that sandwich down there because she was black. And I'm not sure she ever understood that.
How did she react when you told her that?
Very strange, very confused, and as if a whole world of betrayal had fallen on her at that moment.
I remember Carol as a very vivacious, lovable 14-year-old, the third child of Alpha and Alvin, and very well loved and taken care of in the family, and quite active in her schoolwork, quite active in her church work.
I always remember when she was born, my father telling me that I was standing outside in front of the house with my skates on, announcing to everybody that I had a brand new baby sister, and I was so happy to have a little sister.
Carol was a very giving, outgoing person. She had a lot of friends, a lot of friends.
She was a beautiful daughter. She was, you know, the average kid growing up. She was smart. She played music. She was a scout. An avid reader, she worked with the library assistance groups in the city and state. She took dancing lessons. She didn't play the piano, though.
I used to have to take her to the movies, the Saturday movies with me. They were segregated, and we'd have to go upstairs into the balcony. We'd sit and we'd throw popcorn and ice. We would throw them down on the white folks. And And she always thought that was real funny, you know, but she, like, knew that we were not supposed to be doing that. And so it was like, I'm gonna tell.
She played clarinet in the band at elementary school and high school. She was supposed to play her first game that Monday night after the bomb, and the band was supposed to play. Parker was playing somebody, I've forgotten who. This is her last sash with the badges. She was a member at that time of Troop 264, and those were the badges that she had earned, you know, in the process. But she had been a scout all along from Brownie on up. This Bible she had in her pocketbook, you know, the day of the bombing. When we got it, it was said dirt, grit, dirt, and part of this was torn out. But for a long time, I kept it in my pocketbook, but I've taken it out now, and I put it up and look at it every now and then.
In 1949, my last year in college, I went through Birmingham with my boss. I worked in the food service in the school cafeteria, Ernest O'Rourke. And he was telling me on the way down about this section of Birmingham called Dynamite Hill. I said, why do they call it Dynamite Hill? He said, well, it used to be a garbage dump, and they cleared the land and fixed it up, and black people built homes up there, and they're nice homes. He said, and the honkies just bomb them because they resent black folks having a good home. We arrived in Birmingham about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. At 5:30, a bomb went off on Dynamite Hill. Now, that's 1949, and you're going fast forward to 1962.
We're here at Bethel Baptist Church, the church which served as the headquarters for the movement, the change in Birmingham, Alabama, back in the 50s and the 60s. I'm standing at the corner of the church where the house was at that time.
Would you care to tell us about the two bombings?
The first bombing was in December 1956, Christmas night, when somebody planted 12 sticks of dynamite.
The dynamite was placed right here at the corner of the church and would have been the corner of the house.
And that's where the head of my bed was, and I was in the bed.
You can see the cracks in the wall, but the implosive effects went into the house.
So that it blew the wall that was between my head and the dynamite away.
The lights went out, and I felt the head of my bed being driven down, and yet I was not afraid. I knew I wouldn't get killed. I knew there was a presence there.
Well, at that time, see, there was a lot of bombing going on. Even up where I live, they started up on the hill up on Green Springs at that time. It was only about 11 houses, and only about, we were the first black family up there. And they would drive by. In fact, they threw a firebomb into our yard between the houses.
And when the problems came, we all had to just run in our closets when we would hear the bombings or what have you, but it was just a common thing that was happening.
You could be sitting comfortable and the dynamite would go off.
One of the interesting parts of that night, and that's a dramatic situation, the house was leaning and you couldn't get out, so in a crowd, instantaneous, this street was filled within, I guess, two or three minutes. A big burly policeman came back. This policeman decided to give me some advice. And incidentally, he was a Klansman, because about a third of Birmingham policemen either were Klansmen or had Klan affiliation. He said, I really didn't believe that they would go this far. He said, Reverend, I tell you what I'd do if I were you. I'd get out of town as quick as I could. I said, officer, you're not me. And you go back and tell your Klan brethren that if God could keep me through this, that the war is on, the battle has just begun, and I'll be around for the duration.
We'll make like this is back in the 60s.
How old were you back
then? At the time, I was 14.
You were the same age as Cynthia?
The same age. This is the house she was balled up in, right here.
We would play all out here. She would have little lawn parties. She was well liked. We had no idea the tragedy that was going to happen, but she lived a normal life.
Cynthia was, and this is 30-some years ago, but images. Cynthia could have humor. I remember laughing with Cynthia. She could have jokes. Yeah, I remember that well. She was caring. Some people are caring, some are not. I was younger than my classmates, and I was a fat little young boy. So some people didn't want to be bothered with me. Cynthia would be bothered with me. She would. She would take time, you know, and just be nice to me as a human being.
Cynthia Wesley was the daughter of Claude, Mr. and Mrs. Claude Wesley, and he was principal of Lewis School at that time.
Cynthia was a delightful young lady. The Wesleys adopted Cynthia when she was quite young. And she grew up in 16th Street Church with them.
Cynthia was very involved in church. She was in the choir. And in fact, the Sunday of the bombing on September 15th, Cynthia would have begun her first opportunity as an usher on that Sunday.
I was probably closest to Cynthia Wesley. We were in a little club together. And in this club, we had little outfits that matched and hats and so forth, and we had just ordered some new stuff to wear. And in fact, after she was killed, we took what she had ordered to her mom's house and sat and talked to her.
On the Sunday morning, the 15th, when Cynthia and the other girls came to Sunday school, I remember my mother telling me how she had chided Cynthia because as she was coming out of the house, she noticed that her slip was hanging. And my mother told her to go back in the room. In fact, what I'd like to do is just read a little statement about that, because the way my mother presented this to her, I think is something pretty typical that mothers would say to their daughters. My mother stated that, young lady, your slip is hanging below your dress. You just don't put your clothes on anyway when you're going to church, because you never know how you're coming back. Cynthia had hurriedly made the necessary adjustments, then ran out of the door. My mother never saw her after that. I'm sorry. My mother said...
Excerpts of Four Little Girls, the documentary by Spike Lee about the bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama, on September 15th, 1963. This week, two of the people who believed to have set that bomb have been indicted. We'll go back to excerpts of that documentary in just a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Stay with us. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, The Exception to the Rulers. I'm Amy Goodman as we continue with the documentary by Spike Lee, Four Little Girls.
In 1961, the Freedom Riders came to Birmingham. And one of their buses was burned in Anniston, and they had one bus left. They all came on that bus to Birmingham. And they went to the Trailway bus station. National television was waiting for them at the Greyhound bus station. Now, they didn't just meet Freedom Riders. There were people that just come to meet the bus. But one photographer was at the station and took a picture of the beating. They turned on him and beat him and took his camera. On the UPI wire, and it was front page in newspapers all over the world. And there were a group of Birmingham businessmen in Tokyo at the time at a meeting of the International Rotary Club. And when they saw that picture on the front page of a newspaper in Tokyo, Japan, they said, we can't take much more of this.
Birmingham, at the time, was going through a move where some of the moderate forces in the white community were trying to finally assert themselves. And it was a long time overdue.
A state court is expected to rule next week on whether Mayor-elect Albert Boutwell can take office immediately. Boutwell was asked if he's ready to meet with Negro leaders.
I'm ready at any time. When the immediate threat of violence has been removed, to talk to any responsible local people, regardless of the color of their skin.
Birmingham is a symbol of hardcore resistance to integration. It is probably the most thoroughly segregated city in the United States.
SCLC had been really just organized in 1957. About 100 preachers got together in Louisiana. And we hadn't had much luck. We didn't have much staff. And Fred Shuttlesworth came to see Martin Luther King and said, look, Martin, you got to help us in Birmingham. We just got to move on Birmingham.
The federal government has decided that Negro as citizens must be protected from lawlessness and mobocracy. And that's why we applaud.
Fred Shuttlesworth had been fighting the battle in Birmingham for 10 years by this time. And really, the Alabama organization was almost his personal creation right there in Birmingham, in the same sense that SCLC was a personal creation for Dr. King. In the fall of 1962, almost 6 months before the breakthrough in May and about a year before the Birmingham church bombing, Shuttlesworth had an agreement after lots of boycotts in Birmingham with the merchants for what we would now regard as the minimum, most minimum token segregation of allowing black shoppers, mostly women, to shop and use the restrooms and the changing rooms in the downtown stores. He had made these agreements, and then they resegregated everything in the fall of 1962. And I think by then, at that time, his patience ran out, and he said, you know, bravery alone is not enough. We need to bring a larger spotlight to this. And to him, bringing a larger spotlight meant bringing in Dr. King.
So we made a decision based on several things. Fred Shuttlesworth was fearless and courageous to the point of being almost insane. Miraculously survived a bombing of his home. Had taken his wife and two children trying to integrate a school with a mob of 500 or 600 folks with chains and stuff. Just an incredible human being, in my view.
One day in 1957, in the afternoon, the evening newscast, there was a piece of film of a gang of white men beating Fred Shuttlesworth in the street outside Phillips High School, where he'd taken his children with chains, and they beat him to the ground. And the reason it was riveting for me, I was 14 years old, was that the police said they couldn't find the men who did it. And I recognized one of the men. I knew who he was. I'd seen him at Jack Cash's barbecue. And I knew the police hung out at Jack Cash's barbecue. And I knew they were lying.
It was the last place I think I wanted to go with Martin Luther King in 1963. And yet, it was the place we had to go.
Adam A. Collins was a little more withdrawn, I think. Friendly, but not as aggressive as Cynthia or Denise.
To know Addie is to love Addie. She was just a funny girl, a sweet, peaceful girl. She just liked to make peace with people and people to be at peace around, you know. She wasn't a mean person. She was just sweet.
Remember that time with Denise when the bird died and we thought that was the weirdest thing? I have to tell you the bird story. We saw a dead bird. And we're like, just a dead bird. You know, kick it out the way. And Denise said, oh, no, the bird must have a funeral. And we're like, just put it somewhere so we can play. And she said, no, we've got to have a funeral for the poor bird. She got her mother, and Miss McNair has a beautiful voice. She got her mother, she got the shoebox, the boys had to dig a hole, and we buried the bird. And Mrs. McNair sang the Lord's Prayer, and it was beautiful. And then we all bowed, and we prayed, and said something, and you know, and then it's play ball.
The first Sunday that we marched, Palm Sunday, I think it was. No, it wasn't Palm Sunday, it was a Sunday. And the church services of the pastors, the afternoon service ran a little late. We were supposed to march at 4, it was about 6:30. And by the time we got ready to march, it was about 1,200 people out there, milling around Ingram Park, waiting to see something happen. And Bulls folks out there with the dogs. And before you knew it, something was going on between the police with the dogs. And the next day, the UPI said, 1,100 march in Birmingham, 15 arrested. I called Dr. King. I said, Dr. King, I got it. He said, what is it? Why? I said, we just gonna slow down the time of the march till the people get home from work every day, and we'll get a crowd. I said, we can count on Bull to do something silly.
If there's anybody in this nation who understands what is going on here, it is me. I know that we have sufficient manpower, enough trained officers to keep the peace in Birmingham, without any outside help from the federal government. The president
Eugene Bull Connor was the police commissioner, commissioner of fire and safety. It's ironic that safety would be in the hands of a man who was so unsafe, kept people so insecure.
He was about as hardcore as they come. He was one of those people that drew the line and never retreated. I don't think he felt that blacks had any rights. I don't think he felt like they should be citizens even.
Bull kind of liked to keep black folk in their place. All of the arrests and all of the demonstrations in Birmingham occurred within 4 blocks of 16th Street Baptist Church. We'd meet in the church, we'd march a few blocks, and then he'd lock everybody up. And when there were too many people to lock up, he'd call on the dogs and the fire hoses and try to clear the street by force.
When he saw any strength or self-respect in a black person, he just went crazy. I mean, it just, he couldn't stand it. It's like, when you see me, you got to squat. And if, so if you don't become ingratiating, he just like go crazy.
He had a white tank that he would ride through the black neighborhoods and terrorize the people in the neighborhood in his white tank.
There was almost no way to talk to him or reason with him. It was his town. It was like, almost like the old West, where he was one man rule.
Bull was the manifestation of the perversity of upon which segregation depended for its life. Bull was like the walking id of Birmingham, the dark spirit of Birmingham, the hellish side of Birmingham made embodied. I mean, it sounds dramatic, but it was a dramatic time.
You must understand that a Bull Connor couldn't exist without the nods from the status quo people, you know, the big boys in any town. No Bull Connor can exist without them. He may be the person who actually does the talking, but believe me, the Bull Connors have the blessings of somebody else.
in the name of the greatest people that have ever trod this earth, I draw the line in the dust and toss the gauntlet before the feet of tyranny, and I say segregation now, segregation tomorrow, and segregation forever.
I think George Wallace is the cause of many people's death, and certainly much suffering.
The white people of Birmingham should have been commended by the president for their restraint during the present demonstrations. White people have not been involved, only lawless Negroes.
George Wallace was a dynamic expression of the mental derangement of white people. And that, you know, people who are afraid of change and frustration, George Wallace expressed that mental illness. He's dynamic, he's best in the business. Eh?
Now, therefore, I, George C. Wallace, as governor of the state of Alabama, have by my action raised issues between the central government and the sovereign state of Alabama, which said issues should be adjudicated in the manner prescribed by the Constitution of the United States, and now being mindful of my duties and responsibilities under the Constitution of the United States, the Constitution of the state of Alabama, and seeking to preserve and maintain the peace and dignity of this state and the individual freedoms of the citizens thereof, do hereby denounce and forbid this.
The negotiations are unproductive. We have no alternative but to demonstrate. In a meeting today, we discussed all of these issues, and we all agreed that if the present negotiations that are taking place are not productive, we would have no alternative but to call for renewed demonstrations here in Birmingham, Alabama.
The movement was failing. Nobody was even asking questions at press conferences in Washington about what was going on in Birmingham after 2 months of active demonstrations.
The first demonstrations we had were just a handful of people. In fact, when Dr. King himself went to jail, only 55 people would go with him. So when young people today ask me, when are we going to be able to get together like you all were in the 60s? Nobody was together in the 60s. It was a small group of dedicated people who got it started. And then the kids took it over.
In 1963, I was directing the movement in Mississippi for the Southern Christian Leadership Conference in Greenwood. Dr. King and Ralph Abernathy and Shuttlesworth and these guys were trying to get adults, and they had gotten about as many adults. So he called me on the phone and asked me would I come to Birmingham and help to organize the people and the young people. And so I went to Birmingham to help organize the people and the young people to become involved in the movement.
James Bevel, principally, and Andy Young and Dorothy Cotton were given the task to get the college students from Miles, and there was another little junior college there. Bevel, I think, sort of on his own, went down to Parker High School. And the teachers told us that they couldn't go and get in the movement. And they locked the gates. That was it. The fact that the teachers locked the gates, the kids climbed the gates and came and got in the movement. And when the high school kids got in, the junior high school kids, it was like an avalanche. And then the little kids wanted to come. And we got word that the children wanted to march. Kelly Ingram Park on May 3rd was the turning point in the Birmingham movement. And it was a hot day. It was 90 plus and humid in Birmingham. These firemen had been out there for 4 hours waiting for something to happen that wasn't apparently going to happen. And the crowd again had gathered, and somebody threw a brick. And the firemen, you know, in their frustration and longing, they turned that water cannon on.
And it was absolute helter-skelter. How you take blowers and blow leaves and things, but this is how folks were. We were rolling across. The ground, we couldn't grab anything. The dogs were barking, biting. Boys were clubbing and stuff. But the little kids on the inside, for the most part, were protected.
I don't know if anybody has ever even thought about the pressure from one of those hoses. You could just feel it sting. It was almost like being whipped with a whip or something. and just sort of hit me in the face and went this way and took my hair out.
I have always been afraid of dogs. And to have the police department have dogs on us, I mean, there were people being bitten by dogs as we were trying to run away from the dogs and the fire hoses with the water that were literally washing children down the streets.
I was in Princeton, New Jersey, when the fire hoses and the marches in Kelly Ingram Park and near the church were held. They were on the front page of the New York Times. And I recall having to explain to my professors and to my friends every single day that all of Birmingham hadn't erupted in violence. And in fact, it was awfully hard to explain how I didn't really think that fire hoses were the worst thing that could have happened, certainly compared to firearms, certainly compared to killing and beating.
Birmingham, and particularly in the year 1963 when this took place, had become the focal point of the struggle.
On a sweet September morning, 63.
Four little girls, excerpts of the documentary by Spike Lee of the bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama in 1963. Two of the people who were responsible for that bombing were indicted this week for murder. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. Listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, I'm Amy Goodman. Today, May 19th, is the 75th anniversary of the birth of Malcolm X. It's hard to believe Malcolm X would have been 75 years old today. Well, today, with elections approaching, we go to a Malcolm X speech on the ballot or the bullet.
Brothers and sisters, and friends, and I see some enemies. In fact, I think we'd be fooling ourselves if we had an audience this large and didn't realize that there were some enemies present. This afternoon, we want to talk about the ballot or the bullet. The ballot or the bullet explains itself. But before we get into it, since this is the year of the ballot or the bullet, I would like to clarify some things that refer to me personally concerning my own personal position. I'm still a Muslim. That is, my religion is still Islam. My religion is still Islam. I still credit Mr. Muhammad for what I know and what I am. He's the one who opened my eyes. And at present, I'm the minister of the newly founded Muslim Mosque Incorporated, which has its offices in the Teresa Hotel right in the heart of Harlem. That's the Black Belt in New York City. And when we realize that Adam Clayton Powell is a Christian minister, he's the He has the Abyssinia Baptist Church, but at the same time, he's more famous for his political struggling. And Dr. King is a Christian minister in Atlanta, from Atlanta, Georgia, or in Atlanta, Georgia, but he's become more famous for being involved in a civil rights struggle. The same as they are Christian ministers, I'm a Muslim minister. And I don't believe in fighting today in any one front, but on all fronts. In fact, I'm a black nationalist freedom fighter. Islam is my religion, but I believe my religion is my personal business. It governs my personal life, my personal morals, and my religious philosophy is personal between me and the God in whom I believe, just as the religious philosophy of these others is between them and the God in whom they believe. And this is best this way. Were we to come out here discussing religion, we'd have too many differences from the outstart, and we could never get together. So today, though Islam is my religious philosophy, my political, economic, and social philosophy is black nationalism. You and I... As I say, if we bring up religion, we'll have differences, we'll have arguments, we'll never be able to get together. But if we keep our religion at home, keep our religion in the closet, keep our religion between ourselves and our God, but when we come out here, we have a fight that's common to all of us against an enemy who is common to all of us. The political philosophy of black nationalism only means that the black man should control the politics and the politicians in his own community. The time when white people can come in our community and get us to vote for them so that they can be our political leaders and tell us what to do and what not to do is long gone. By the same token, the time when that same white man, knowing that your eyes are too far open, can send another Negro into the community, get you and me to support him so he can use him to lead us astray, those days are long gone. The political philosophy of black nationalism only means that if you and I are going to live in a black community, and that's where we're going to live, because as soon as you move into one of their, soon as you move out of the black community into their community, it's mixed for a period of time, but they are gone, and you're right there all by yourself. We must understand the politics of our community, and we must know what politics is supposed to produce. We must know what part politics play in our lives. And until we become politically mature, we will always be misled, led astray, or deceived, or maneuvered into supporting someone politically who doesn't have the good of our community at heart. So the political philosophy of black nationalism only means that we will have to carry on a program, a political program of re-education, to open our people's eyes, make us become more politically conscious, politically mature. And then we will, whenever we get ready to cast our ballot, that ballot will be cast for a man of the community who has the good of the community at heart. And the economic philosophy of black nationalism only means that we should own and operate and control the economy of our community. You would never find, you can't open up a black store in a white community. White man won't even patronize you. And he's not wrong. He got sense enough to look out for himself. And you who don't have sense enough to look out for yourself. The white man is too intelligent to let someone else come and gain control of the economy of his community.
But you will let anybody come in and control the economy of your community, control the housing, control the education, control the jobs, control the businesses, under the pretext that you want to integrate. No, you're out of your mind. The political, the economic philosophy of black nationalism only means that we have to become involved in a program of re-education to educate our people into the importance of knowing that when you spend your dollar out of the community in which you live, the community in which you spend your money becomes richer and richer. The community out of which you take your money becomes poorer and poorer. And because these Negroes who have been misled, misguided, are breaking their necks to take their money and spend it with the man is becoming richer and richer, and you're becoming poorer and poorer. And then what happens? The community in which you live becomes a slum. It becomes a ghetto. The conditions become run down. And then you have the audacity to complain about poor housing in a rundown community. Why, you run it down yourself when you take your dollar out. And you and I are in a double trap, because not only do we lose by taking our money someplace else and spending it, when we try and spend it in our own community, we're trapped because we haven't had sense enough to set up stores and control the businesses of our community. The man who's controlling the stores in our community is a man who doesn't look like we do. He's a man who doesn't even live in the community. So you and I, even when we try and spend our money in the block where we live or the area where we live, we're spending it with a man who, when the sun goes down, takes that basket full of money in another part of the town. So we're trapped, double trapped, triple trapped. Anywhere we go, we find that we're trapped. And every kind of solution that someone comes up with is just another trap. But the political and economic philosophy of black nationalism, the economic philosophy of black nationalism shows our people the importance of setting up these little stores and developing them and expanding them into larger operations. Woolworth didn't start out big like they are today. They started out with a dime store and expanded and expanded and expanded until today they're all over the country and all over the world, and they're getting some of everybody's money. Now, this is what you and I and General Motors, the same way, didn't start out like it is. It started out just a little rat race type operation, and it expanded and expanded until today it's where it is right now. And you and I have to make a start. And the best place to start is right in the community where we live. So our people not only have to be re-educated to the importance of supporting black business, but the black man himself has to be made aware of the importance of going into business. And once you and I go into business, we own and operate at least the businesses in our community, what we will be doing is developing a situation wherein we will actually be able to create employment for the people in the community. And once you can create some employment in the community where you live, it will eliminate the necessity of you and me having to act ignorantly and disgracefully, boycotting and picketing some cracker someplace else, trying to beg him for a job. Anytime you have to rely upon your enemy for a job, you're in bad shape. When you, and he is your enemy, anytime, you wouldn't be in this country if some enemy hadn't kidnapped you and brought you here. On the other hand, some of you think you came here on the Mayflower. So as you can see, brothers and sisters, today, this afternoon, it's not our intention to discuss religion. We're going to forget religion. If we bring up religion, we'll be in an argument. And the best way to keep away from arguments and differences, as I said earlier, put your religion at home, in the closet. Keep it between you and your God. Because if it hasn't done anything more for you than it has, you need to forget it anyway. whether you are a Christian or a Muslim or a nationalist, we all have the same problem. They don't hang you because you're a Baptist, they hang you because you're black. They don't attack me because I'm a Muslim, they attack me because I'm black. They attack all of us for the same reason. All of us catch hell from the same enemy. We're all in the same bag, in the same boat. We suffer political oppression, economic exploitation, and social degradation. All of them from the same enemy. The government has failed us. You can't deny that. Anytime you live in the 20th century and you walking around here singing, "We shall overcome," the government has failed us. This is part of what's wrong with you. You do too much singing. Today, it's time to stop singing and start swinging. You can't sing up on freedom, but you can swing up on some freedom. Cassius Clay can sing, but singing didn't help him to become the heavyweight champion of the world. So this government has failed us. The government itself has failed us. And the white liberals who have been posing as our friends have failed us. And once we see that all these other sources to which we've turned have failed, we stop turning to them and turn to ourselves. We need a self-help program, a do-it-yourself philosophy, a do-it-right-now philosophy, it's already too late philosophy. This is what you and I need to get with. And the only way we're going to solve our problem is with a self-help program. Before we can get a self-help program started, we have to have a self-help philosophy. Black nationalism is a self-help philosophy. What's so good about it? You can stay right in the church where you are and still take black nationalism as your philosophy. You can stay in any kind of civic organization that you belong to and still take black nationalism as your philosophy. You can be an atheist and still take black nationalism as your philosophy. This is a philosophy that eliminates the necessity for division and argument. Because if you're black, you should be thinking black. And if you're black and you're not thinking black at this late date, well, I'm sorry for you.
Malcolm X, his speech, "The Ballot or the Bullet," relevant even today, in the year 2000, as the presidential election approaches. That does it for today's program. Democracy Now! Is produced by David Love and Jeremy Scahill. Errol Maitland's our technical director. Matthew Finch is our engineer. From the studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!